From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Bob Herbert was a columnist for the New York Times from 1993 to 2011. He focused on America's disadvantaged, on those who did not have it easy. He championed America as a place where the American dream could be there for all. Bob Herbert set that pen down 3 years ago and hit the road. He's come back with a book with a strong message that America's not working for the 99%. This hour On Point, former New York Times columnist Bob Herbert says we're losing our way and thinking, talking about how to find it again. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you see? Have we lost our way? Why? And how do we get it back? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, Daniel McCarthy, the editor of the American Conservative, joins us to mix it up with Bob Herbert a little bit, maybe a different perspective. First, joining me from New York, Bob Herbert. He was a regular op-ed page columnist for the New York Times for 18 years until 2011. He's now a distinguished senior fellow at the liberal public policy think tank Demos. Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, Tony Norman describes his moral clarity, his relentless truth-telling, and his unbending sense of fair play. Bob Herbert's new book is Losing Our Way, An Intimate Portrait of a Troubled America. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Bob Herbert in New York, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Tom. I appreciate it.
Was it a shock for you stepping out of the regular, you know, writing of that column? You hit the road in all kinds of ways over a couple of years following that. Were you having sensory deprivation?
No, not at all. I told people, people were asking me afterwards if I missed the column, and I was telling people that 41 years on deadline is enough. So I'd been a newspaper man for 41 years, and I'd been writing a column for 25.
Yeah.
So it was not any kind of sensory deprivation. It was more a feeling of relief and freedom.
You headed out into the country. It's not as though you didn't travel and look around when you were writing your column, but I'm guessing you were able to travel and talk to people in a different way, Bob, without that deadline hanging over you.
Exactly right. I wanted to get more in depth on issues. The column is about 750 or 800 words, and I wanted to be able to spend a little more time with people and write a little more expansively. These were the stories that I encountered were not issues that I hadn't heard before. I was very familiar with them, but I was able to spend more time with them, and frankly, it was quite gratifying.
The name of your book is Losing Our Way. That was also the headline of your last column for the New York Times. Does that mean you went out with a quite fixed preconception of what was going on in this country? Did you find the thing you were looking for, Bob?
I wouldn't say that it was a preconception. It was more a case of that was the feeling that I had based on the stories that I had been covering for the Times for a long time, for many years. So I wanted to find out. I knew that we were losing our way when I wrote that column in 2011. I wanted to find out why it was, what was behind it, and what it would take to get back on track again. That was the point of going out there.
Give us a sense of some of the places you visited, some of the stories you found that you found particularly illustrative.
The book opens with a story about a woman in Minneapolis.
Yeah.
Her name is Mercedes Gordon, and she was a 32-year-old woman who was in her car and went down on that I-35 bridge and the terrible bridge collapse into the Mississippi River back in 2007. And she becomes a thread through the book because she was really badly injured. She's a wonderful woman, delightful person. I really liked her a lot, but she was badly injured. And I followed her recovery, her recuperation, and the struggles that she went through recovering from this terrible accident. But that was also a way of opening a window onto the problem of our decrepit infrastructure in this country. The infrastructure is in much worse shape than most Americans realize. It's not just about roads and bridges. It's about much more than that. It's about the electrical grid and so on. So I followed her story. And then
Stand by for 1 second, Bob. I've got news to bring that back to mind for people. This was August 2nd, 2007. And yes, this was Minneapolis, I-35 West. The bridge collapsed there from KCRA.
The interstate bridge over the Mississippi collapsed right during the middle of the rush hour. It has dumped the latest report saying at least eight cars and a truck into the water and into the land below, creating this rather horrific scene of damage, fire, smoke, injuries, and frantic rescue operations. And as you can well imagine, a lot of terrified motorists there as well.
First decrepit, then horrific. What did you learn out of Mercedes' story, Bob?
Well, The first
she went
thing
down
learned,
with the bridge, right?
13 people were killed, mm-hmm. and it was remarkable that more people didn't lose their lives in that catastrophe. Dozens were badly injured. The two things that I learned was, one, how difficult it was to recuperate from the most severe injuries, the people who were many people who were horribly injured in that catastrophe had a terrible time coming back, and in many cases never fully recovered. They weren't the same people afterwards. But what I also did was the research and bridge collapses and other infrastructure catastrophes in the United States. And you'll find that that bridge collapses were not all that unusual, that there have been a history of them over a long period of time. And one of the reasons is because we don't maintain these structures. We don't do our due diligence.
Why not?
In terms of taking care of them. In part because our policymakers, elected politicians, have to decide on a number of priorities. And infrastructure is, I like to say, the least sexy word in the language. So you don't get votes by going out and talking about painting bridges, even though the bridges need to be painted. So what happens is money that should go into maintenance and upgrading of things like bridges and dams and that sort of thing, highways and overpasses, actually go to other things. Sometimes it goes to take care of budget deficits. Sometimes it goes into schools, which are important as well. Sometimes it goes to cut taxes. And then we don't really pay attention until something terrible happens.
You write about schools and Pittsburgh in particular.
Pittsburgh was another place that I went to, and again, I used the Pittsburgh situation to illustrate what is, in fact, a national problem. In Pittsburgh, you had a couple of parents who were fighting against what were devastating budget cuts that came at the time of the Great Recession. This was a few years after the terrible downturn of 2008-2009. There was a new governor in Pittsburgh, and he cut nearly $2 billion from the education budget for the state. And it was just devastating. All kinds of classes were cut. Teachers and support personnel were laid off, actually fired. Bands were closed. Sports programs were eliminated. It was really a terrible situation. And you had these two women that I talked to, their names were Jesse Ramey and Kathy Newman. They were both college-level instructors themselves, and they had small children in the public school system. And they joined the fight, a true grassroots fight of parents in Pittsburgh and around the state of Pennsylvania who fought back against these budget cuts and against further cuts that the administration wanted to make in public education. And they fended off a great deal of the cuts. And one of the things that I thought was really important about that was that it illustrated what is a central theme of my book, that we've lost our way because many of our elected leaders have had either the wrong priorities or have not followed through as they claimed they would on the big issues of our time. And I think the time has come for people to fight back at the grassroots level, and that's what they did with a great deal of success in Pittsburgh.
Well, look at what that fighting back might mean. Bob Herbert, in his new book, Losing Our Way, looks at failing infrastructure, he's mentioned, inadequate education, income inequality, a big theme here, and also the moral, monetary, physical costs of war, too many wars. Are those kind of equal weight in your assessment of where we've gone off track, Bob?
You know, it's hard to assign proper weight to issues, especially when tragedies are involved. Warfare is always horrific, and, you know, I'm not a pacifist. I was in the Army a long time ago. But I think that you should fight wars only when they're absolutely necessary. I thought that it certainly was necessary to respond to the terrible terror attacks of September 11, 2001. But here it is, 2014, almost 2015, and we're still in Afghanistan. We've reengaged in Iraq, and we have no idea, no real plan. What's our goal? Where is it all going to end? Along the way, many thousands of young men and women have been killed. Young American men and women have been killed. Scores of thousands have been terribly wounded, all kinds of psychological scars. Hundreds of thousands of foreigners killed in these wars. And we don't know where it's going to end. It's been devastating, and to a great extent, it's been self-destructive.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with former New York Times columnist Bob Herbert about what he found when he left the Times in 2011 and set out across the country. He found trouble in the USA, in the land and lives of the 99%. He's written it up in a new book called Losing Our Way, An Intimate Portrait of a Troubled America. Daniel McCarthy, editor of the American Conservative, joins us in a few minutes. Bob Herbert is with us. Herbert is with us right now from New York. And Bob, lots of callers for you. John in New Orleans. John, you're on the air with Bob Herbert.
Hi, Tom. I'd like to say that I'm just astonished that it's taken this long for a credible journalist to address this issue. I'm originally from Connecticut, and sometime years ago in the 70s and the 80s, the Mianus River Bridge collapsed on I-95, Interstate 95 in Greenwich, Connecticut. It's one of the major arteries into and out of New York City. And Mr. Herbert, early on in the interview, said that infrastructure is one of the least sexy words in the lexicon. And since when is governance supposed to be sexy? Paying the bills, repairing the infrastructure, paying for veterans' benefits, these things aren't sexy. But if you want to have a world-class culture and a nation that leads the world in its lifestyle and quality of life, you have to pay for it.
John, I appreciate your call. Let me pick it up right there with Bob, if I may. I really appreciate your call. Bob Herbert, how about it? It's not supposed to be sexy. It's governance. Take that, if you would, to our politics. If we've lost our way in politics somehow, that taking care of essential business is not important anymore?
I couldn't agree more with the caller. I think the caller is absolutely on point, which is the name of your program. Sure, we should be taking care of these important issues. The caller mentioned the obligation to pay for the costs of our wars, veterans' benefits, and that sort of thing, which we have not paid a lot of attention to, and infrastructure. Of course, the issues shouldn't have to be sexy for our elected officials to engage them, but that's what's happened over the past few decades. Our elected officials are much more interested in raising money with an eye on the next election. The campaign season is now around the clock. It used to be you would campaign for a couple of months or a few months, and then you'd get down to the business of governing. That's no longer the case. We're in a perennial campaign. Politicians are interested in, their few moments on television. Can they make their point? Do they have the right sound bites?
Why is that, Bob? Does that go back to the voters? Is it their fault? Attention span of a flea kind of critique, or why?
I think voters have to take a bit of a hit here, but I think it's really a problem of leadership in general. I think that our leaders have just lost sight of what's important. It's as if they live their lives looking in a mirror. What's best for me, or what's best for me and my donors? which is why I make the argument in the book that what we need is more civic engagement from ordinary people. I actually think that we need a movement. I'd love to see a movement develop around the issue of employment issues and the rights of workers. But I think that things are not going to change unless ordinary people step up and demand change. And until that happens, we're going to continue to go the route that we're going. And the route that we're going is the route of the 99% versus the 1%. It can sound simplistic, but it's really true. The top echelon, a small sliver of our population, takes almost all the benefits from growth, so that even when you get some governmental growth, the benefits of that growth do not go to ordinary working men and women. That needs to change.
You say you want broad civic engagement, people really getting engaged, and you're talking middle class. You're talking the poor. You're talking all that, but you also write in a way that makes me wonder if that's coming. You say that as you traveled around the country, you say, I couldn't help but notice that something fundamental in the very character of the United States has shifted. You write, there was a sense of powerlessness and resignation among ordinary people that I hadn't been used to. How do powerlessness, a sense of powerlessness and resignation, those don't sound like how Americans traditionally look at themselves, like to think of themselves. How do those translate into civic engagement?
That's exactly right. So that's why we need more civic engagement. We don't have enough of it. I'm a child of the 50s and the 60s when civic engagement was all over the place. I mean, you had the civil rights movement, you had the women's movement, you had the anti-war movement. You had so much going on. Labor was still strong. And people just felt that they could have an effect, that they could change government and change policies for the better. I mentioned in the author's note or introduction to the book that it's not that things were perfect. They weren't perfect by any means back in the 50s and 60s. African Americans and women were treated in many ways horrifically. But people felt that they could change their circumstances. They felt that the country was moving in the right direction, that there would be a better day for blacks in America, that there would be a better day for women in America, that people who were opposed to the war in Vietnam believed that they could bring that war to an end. I don't feel that same kind of optimism and energy now, although there is a great deal of frustration and anger. If somehow that frustration and anger could be changed into greater civic engagement, we would begin to see some changes in policies.
Bob, a lot of people are responding to you online, on Twitter, Facebook, and the website. Let me just give you some of the expanded consciousness says, maybe as pushback on that, says optimism is the American status quo. There's one. Here's another. Dwight says, the U.S. is so lost, nothing can save us now. Violence, civil unrest, chaos is our future. It's inevitable. Here's another from Worthy, who looks back and sees things differently, says, lost our way? Recent news indicates that we are keeping in touch with the way we always were, a punitive, reactionary society easily persuaded by fear, through fear. And then one more, Creaker says, people have forgotten the middle class wasn't built from what was freely given by the wealthy. It was fought for. There's a range of initial reaction, Bob.
There's a lot of energy in those comments. I'll pick up on the comment about the middle class was built by things that people fought for. I think that the middle class has gotten the short end of the stick. Working people in general have, as have poor people. So I think that people need to fight back. I think that people need to fight for a larger slice of the economic pie in this country. I think workers who are consistently provided low wages and jobs with no benefits, often part-time jobs. Sometimes people go to work and they don't know from week to week what shift they're going to be working. I think these workers ought to be fighting back and saying that, you know, we should be treated with greater dignity, and that if we're going to put in a decent day's work, then we ought to receive a decent day's pay. All of these things are grist for a movement in this country that would provide what I think of as a fairer, more equitable society. I'm just thinking that people should be treated fairly. If you work hard, you should make a decent income. You shouldn't have to worry about supporting your family.
Let's get a call from California here. Willits, California. Anthony's calling. Anthony, you're on the air with Bob Herbert.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
You know, I really appreciate the call for a pushback. I'm a retired teacher, and, you know, we've seen for the past few years sort of this wave of education reform that says that poverty doesn't matter and that teachers need to be held accountable for raising test scores, everything about test scores. And I'm part of a grassroots pushback called the Network for Public Education. For the past few years, NBC has held a celebration of this model of corporate reform called Education Nation. This Saturday, we're doing a live webcast from New York called Public Education Nation, where we're going to have community activists and parents, students, a student from Chicago talking about school closures. We're going to have people talking about real reform. I hope we can't wait for the media. That, you know, somebody was talking about journalism. Journalism seems to have fallen to the billionaires, and we need to take to the airwaves ourselves, and that's what we're doing this Saturday.
Anthony, I appreciate your call. Bob Herbert, you spend a lot of time looking at education, and you're not so big on the privatization, the charter push. Anthony's on your wavelength there. Why, Bob?
Well, he mentioned testing. Testing is a tool, so there's a place for testing in schools as elsewhere to find out how we're doing, where we could do better, where things are going haywire, and that sort of thing. But we've gone so far overboard on testing in the public schools that it's nuts. Testing in many cases has become the be-all and end-all so that teachers teach to the test. And we've had a range of cheating scandals from coast to coast and that sort of thing. Testing has spiraled out of control. What you want to do is get back to the more traditional public education that we used to have with not just the fundamental subjects, but with things like art and music in the school, civic education, extracurricular activities, and those sorts of things. And then the caller made what I think is the most important point. The students in our public schools who are doing the poorest are the students who come from the least advantaged economic backgrounds. These are the poorest kids. If you took the poor kids out of the equation, America's public schools would be among the best in the world. And when these corporate-style reformers say that poverty doesn't matter, they're just wrong. You can't do well academically if you're coming to school hungry or if you're coming to school with illnesses that haven't been properly treated, or if you have you need eyeglasses but you don't have them. If you're coming from a home where there's domestic difficulties, perhaps domestic violence, perhaps alcohol or drug abuse problems, if you're coming from a situation where you've been exposed to violence, all of these things take a real toll on academic achievement. And the idea that you could just bring in some hotshot outsider with some kind of corporate background and turn this around without addressing the root causes of the problems, I think is just silly.
Bob Herbert's new book is Losing Our Way. Lauren in Boston. Thank you for calling, Lauren. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
So I completely agree with your guest, although I see myself very, very privileged, and but for years working with victims of violence and abuse, and seeing the veterans issues, seeing so much social inequality, and you know, 2,000 veterans commit suicide. I don't know if it's a day or a week, but it doesn't really matter. It's a huge number. People who are whose issues aren't addressed. What your guest just said about education and you know, the poorest families, that we are not really addressing the immediate needs. I feel like in my work, I can't really. I don't have foundation anymore. You know what I mean? That there is no, there is nothing that I can build on.
What is your work, Lauren? Are you in?
Victims of violence and abuse. Mm-hmm. I'm an advocate and mm-hmm. Counselor,
mm-hmm.
and it's just they are coming with so many issues. You know, it's obviously abuse is a pattern, and but they, you know, they either it's they are coming from poverty, lack of education, parents' unemployment. Mm-hmm. You know, the heroin abuse in Massachusetts is skyrocketing. The families of color are still being, you know, in a way discriminated because of, you know, either lack of language, because of
yes.
of parents lack of education, and it's ongoing, and I feel like definitely politicians are completely detached from what's going on here, and Massachusetts is one of the, you know, richest states, and I don't even know how to, you know, I do a lot of pro bono work. I'm very passionate. I'm very involved. And I feel like even in the agencies, like what's happening with child services, you know, that we are losing children or there is so much incompetence. The same with
Lauren, we've got it. Our time is short before the break. I want to take it to Bob Herbert. We hear the frustration right there. And Bob, that sense from Lauren that she has no foundation to stand on in this work. That goes to that hopelessness you're writing about.
Exactly. You know, these problems have gotten out of control because we've ignored them for so long. So, for example, our public officials hardly ever talk about poverty, but poverty is an enormous problem in this country. You don't hear much talk about infrastructure. It's not just that the infrastructure needs to be rebuilt, which it does, but that would also be a fantastic source of new and, in many cases, very good jobs. We spent a lot of time talking about education over the past couple of decades, but it's been pretty much a one-way street. It's been testing charter schools, corporate-style reforms, and they have not radically improved public education. But while at the same time we're talking about these reforms, we've radically cut funding for public education, not just in primary and secondary education, but we've cut the funding for our public colleges and universities. This is a way of handicapping the younger generations who are trying to get a foothold on a decent life in this country. So if we're doing all these things that are harming large numbers of our citizens, and we are not even paying very close attention to what's going on, of course we would find ourselves in a terrible fix. And that's where we are now.
Why harm our own citizens? Why would a country do that?
You know, that's an excellent question, and it's one of the things that baffles me. I think that a society that was constructive would be trying to move in a more positive direction. For many years now, we seem not to have been doing that.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with former New York Times columnist Bob Herbert about what he found when he left the Times in 2011 and set out across the country. Short story, he found trouble in the USA, in the land and lives of the 99%. He's written it up in a new book called Losing Our Way, an intimate portrait of a troubled America. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Bob Herbert, stand by if you would in New York. I want to mix it up a little bit here with Daniel McCarthy. He joins us from Alexandria, Virginia. He's editor of the American Conservative. Daniel McCarthy, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
I don't like to buy straight into the perfect polarity view of America, so I'm not sure at all that you'll disagree with Bob Herbert on every point, but you may have a different perspective as you look at this. I wonder if we can go down his big punch list with you for just a second and then have the two of you join in conversation here. Infrastructure, Daniel, as a conservative, do you see problems in infrastructure in our country? He's got a woman who, you know, the whole bridge collapsed on her, and Bob sees more than a metaphor in that. He sees a warning sign.
Well, absolutely, and I think you'll find plenty of conservatives agree that our infrastructure is in a terrible, dilapidated shape and needs to be rebuilt and repaired. What I would point out, however, is that, as Bob mentions in his book, Losing Our Way, some of the reconstruction that's needed is enormously expensive, and Bob even mentions this will include such measures as raising taxes on working-class people as well as the wealthy.
But what's the alternative, Daniel, if you don't want bridges falling down? And
there's no alternative when it comes to critical infrastructure, bridges and so forth. But if there are larger programs of infrastructural renewal, they have to be prioritized along with a number of other considerations. So one question is, you know, to what extent is the trade-off, non-critical infrastructure versus more misery, more sort of hardship for working people who are already having difficult times making ends meet?
But, I mean, even the poor have to drive to work and they don't want to think they're going to fall down as on their way. Bob Herbert says we'd create a lot of jobs by rebuilding our infrastructure, kind of a self-healing, organism there.
Well, you have to, again, think about the long-term job benefits that may come from infrastructure, but also the short-term difficulty and pain that comes from, a higher burden on working-class people and everyone else as well. And, you know, even the rich who may seem to have ample means to support such things, their money is, oftentimes used to create private sector jobs. You don't want to necessarily trade off fewer of those in order to have more sort of infrastructure jobs created by the government, which then, of course, gets into a lot of moral hazard questions about misallocation of resources and so forth. So by all means, we do need to renew our critical infrastructure. But what I'm saying is I think we have to take a very careful, granular look at exactly which programs need to be prioritized and not simply say that infrastructure as a panacea, as a sort of generic category, is something we can just throw money at and expect wonderful results.
Bob Herbert, tax the rich and more to rebuild the infrastructure. You say we'll have jobs in a better society. You hear Daniel saying, watch out, the job creators may be handicapped.
I'm not sure how much disagreement we have here. I absolutely think that we need to be looking closely at the overall infrastructure situation and prioritizing. We need to decide, where the money is going to come from and then how the resources are supposed to be allocated. I'll give you an example. I mean, we knew for a long, long time that the city of New Orleans was going to be vulnerable if a large hurricane hit it head on. And we knew that the levees were not in good shape. And yet we did not shore those levees up, and we ended up with a catastrophe. My argument is that we need to be paying closer attention and serious attention and finding out how these resources should be allocated. In terms of raising the money to pay for infrastructure, it would be incredibly expensive, although interest rates have been historically low for a long time. Mm-hmm. So ultimately, there are serious economists, who argue that this might ultimately pay for itself. But in any event, to raise the initial funds, I believe that, as in other aspects of our society, there should be shared sacrifice. I think the wealthy people need to be taxed more, but I don't think that all the money can come from the wealthy. I think that the tax burden should be spread through the entire society. I think middle-class people and working people need to be paying more taxes because there are a lot of issues, not just infrastructure, that need to be dealt with that are costly in this country.
Daniel McCarthy, let's go to inequality for a moment. Bob Herbert points to it as a major source of woe in this country, both in everyday life and in our politics, kind of a corrupting dynamic and a very painful one for people who aren't sharing in the wealth that is there. What would you do about that, Daniel? Do you see it as a problem?
Well, it certainly is a problem, and it's unfortunately a bipartisan problem. It's something that we've seen occur under the Clinton administration. It's something we've seen occur under the Bush administration, and now, unfortunately, really getting even worse under Barack Obama. So it's something that it doesn't fit easily into partisan categories, and very clearly, not only do you have groups like Occupy Wall Street, which are directly focused on this, but you're finding an increasing number of conservatives and libertarians talking about what they call crony capitalism and talking about the way that our banking system, for example, really does privilege itself and reward itself much to the detriment of ordinary working Americans. And that's a collaboration between the banking sector and government that certainly benefits a kind of elite class in this country, but really doesn't benefit the rest of the 99%, and that includes the 99% of conservatives and grassroots people in the Republican Party, as well as people from a more progressive standpoint.
Bob Herbert, what about inequality? Do you see it as a nonpartisan issue?
Well, I think it may be nonpartisan in the sense that inequality has grown under both Republican and Democratic administrations. I think that Democrats would be more likely to do something about inequality than Republicans would tend to be. But I don't think either party at the national level really wants to engage the issue of inequality. If you're going to deal with inequality, what you're really going to have to do is redistribute some wealth in this country, and people don't even want to talk about that. One of the ways you do that is through tax policies. But another way that you do that is by giving workers a fairer deal. Pay people more for a day's work. Increase the benefits that workers get when they're putting in their 40 hours or 35 hours or 50 hours or however many hours they're putting in. And I don't see much political support for these kinds of things going forward. So I might say that this is bipartisan in a negative sense, both that Democrats and Republicans have been responsible for inequality, Republicans more so than Democrats, but neither party wants to do much about it.
And there's the redistribution idea. I want to get some listeners in, if I may. Detroit, Michigan, Sean's calling. Hi, Sean. You're on the air with Bob Herbert and Daniel McCarthy.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to give a different angle. I used to go into the automotive plants and see, like, in the 80s, a Chrysler engine plant that used to employ 200 people, and with the advancement of technology, it's reduced down to maybe 20 or 30 technicians in there now.
What, it's all automated. It's robots building the cars, the engine, Sean.
Oh, even Ford's F-150 plant, they have a program, tugs, that pull the parts to the presses, and they don't, they even reduce Hilux driver jobs.
Yeah.
I mean, there's very few jobs there.
So what's your observation out of that, Sean, the automation of industrial work?
Well, yeah, that part there is just plainly obvious to me. I'm a truck driver. I would deliver the parts to the plants there and see the changes, over the years. I work with 40-year-old men at my job, and I see them when they go home from work and relax. They play video games. I mean, 40-year-olds playing video games. It's another technology, I think is hurting our population. The adults aren't taking their kids to the library, teach them how to find materials in the library. They're not taking them to museums, They're doing things like that.
So, first of all, the robot takes the job, and if you've got it, you go home and play the video game. Sean, I appreciate your call. Bob Herbert, how do we get serious about really finding jobs with all this robotization moving in, robotics moving in, automation moving in? Where are these jobs going to come from?
That's such an important point. I mean, we've talked about globalization for a long time, but it may be the technological advancements have cost us even more jobs than globalization. And those jobs, those kinds of jobs are not going to come back. They're lost permanently. The real question, and one of the reasons why we should be paying so much more attention to employment, which I think is the biggest challenge facing the country, the real question is whether our economy can continue to, or whether it's capable of providing enough jobs for all the men and women who want and need to work. It may be that the economy is not capable of doing that. And if that's the case, then as a society, we've got to look at what happens to the people who are left out. Do we need a guaranteed annual income? Do we want government to be the employer of last resort? These are serious issues, and once again, we're not paying attention to them.
Daniel McCarthy, traditionally conservatives say, let's innovate. Let's innovate our way out of this, and Americans have done that many times. We've also had serious social and political reorganizations at different times. How do we handle this? Innovation, or do we need to reconsider a social compact to deal with the new economics?
Well, all of this is well worth discussing. I do think the technological problem is central. One of the things that comes through in Bob's book is he thinks of the 1960s as being an era to which we can return and which has the ethos and spirit and the kind of economy that America should seek to have again. And it just seems to me that the technology has really reversed its effect on our employment situation. In the 1960s, technology was being just developed in computers and manufacturing and aerospace, things that really did employ a lot of people. Now we've gotten to a point where technology is being applied in ways that make some of our production efforts so efficient that they actually put more people out of work. So this does create, I think, a fundamental problem, a structural problem, about what it means to have employment in America. What do we see the picture as being going forward? And, you know, you've seen even some libertarians talk about the idea of a guaranteed income as an alternative to having a welfare state, as, you know, something that, you know, a few of them are willing to contemplate in this really serious situation. But I don't think we need to go quite that far yet. And I think that, in fact, we can look at countries like Germany and Japan that have lower rates of unemployment and look at what they've done in terms of industrial policy that has worked for them.
John McCarthy, we're going to take it on home with Bob Herbert. We really appreciate you joining us for a few minutes today. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you, Tom.
Daniel McCarthy, editor at the American Conservative. Eileen, on State Route 52 near Darlington, South Carolina, you're on with Bob Herbert, Eileen.
Mr. Herbert.
Hi.
Just a little background to show you where I'm coming from. I'm a social historian, and I'm a healthcare journalist. So in healthcare, we have been talking about the social determinants of health now for about 2 years. Sadly, it's obvious we're not getting that out to the public, but I'm not here to talk about healthcare. I'm here to talk about the fact that in the 60s and the 70s, lawyers led the civil rights movement. Lawyers aren't leading the civil rights movement today. How is that impacting all the issues that we are talking about?
Well, I think that very good question. I think that lawyers were critically important to the civil rights movement and other movements back in the 50s and 60s. But it wasn't just lawyers. There were leaders kind of across the board. And what we have now is a dearth of leadership, which is one of the reasons why I think that we've fallen back so far. So I think one of the things that happened, if you look at civil rights, is that because so many advances were made, a lot of the folks who were leaders in the civil rights movement actually gained entry into the corporate community, into America, actually gained entry into academia, actually gained entry into government. So a lot of the folks who would have been leaders of a movement on the grassroots level are now part of the establishment, or are now part of the, in many cases, the power elite. And I think that they've sort of lost sight of their responsibilities to those who were left behind. And there were enormous numbers of Americans who were left behind, not just African Americans. So that's why I think that because this responsibility, in my view, has been largely shirked, that's why I think that it's so important to have some kind of serious, sustained movement developed at the local level, led by ordinary men and women, that would produce a new cadre of leadership for this country.
Bob Herbert, how do we do this? How do we have a more tuned in, maybe more caring, maybe some redistribution in their society, and at the same time keep the incentives for hard work and innovation that have been important historically in pushing the economy up and on?
I think that's really tough. I mean, because in order to be effective, you have to be well organized, and you have to be willing to sacrifice over a long period of time. I mentioned this in the book. If you go back to the early days of the labor movement, these were folks who were in lousy jobs, and nobody would have bet that they could be successful in the long term. Same thing with the civil rights movement. The people who began to sit in at the lunch counters, people thought that they were, like, you know, a little bit nuts, maybe just a nuisance or annoying. The women's movement was not taken seriously in the beginning. But all of those movements developed leaders who were able to rally people for the long term. Terrible sacrifices were made in the labor movement and the civil rights movement. Lives were lost. It's that kind of spirit that needs to be developed now if, in fact, we're going to make the progress that we need to make.
Bob Herbert writes, if our nation is to be changed for the better, ordinary citizens will have to intervene aggressively in their own fate. That's a call to action right there, Bob.
Yes, it is. And I think that it's essential if we're going to really move this country in the right direction.
What do you call this new movement? Not civil rights exactly. If we've lost our way, what do you call this finding our way movement? Bob Herbertism?
That's a great question. I'd love to come up with a catchy name. I'll work on that.
You're the columnist. I think you can do it. Bob, thank you very much for being with us today. The new book is Losing Our Way, An Intimate Portrait of a Troubled America. Bob Herbert in New York. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks so much, Tom. I loved it.
Great to have you. Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.